From Los Angeles, California, this is the Writer's Strike Chronicles, and I'm Tanya Barnes. Hello, everybody. Today is Sunday, February 10th, 2008, day 98 of the writer's strike. Last night, the members of the WGA met with their leadership to discuss the terms of a proposed contract agreement. At the time of this recording, there is no official word from a representative of the WGA or on their website about the results of this meeting. Since that time, I've received a few emails from writers and strike captains who were present in the auditorium, and from these communications, I get a strong feeling that things went well. However, there are some conflicting reports as to the details, so I advise all my listeners to check with the WGA website for any updates. In today's episode, we'll conclude our series of recordings with my late father, Roy Barnes, who worked in the entertainment industry as an IATSE member in both the Art Directors Guild and the Set Designers and Model Makers Guild. Here, we'll hear him talk about the collaborative process in filmmaking from the perspective of the art department. We'll also hear stories about what it was like to work with Clint Eastwood, Robert Redford, and Sylvester Stallone. In mid-October 2006, my dad was hospitalized and in an intensive care unit at St. Joseph's Medical Center for about 5 days. I went to see him daily and brought with me my recorder. Strangely enough, it was the most time I'd ever spent with him since I was a small girl. He told me so many stories, and if it sounds like his career trajectory came easy, I'm here to tell you that it was not. I remember the lean times when our family was on welfare and we would get Christmas presents from our church because we were too broke. My dad told me in every story about how hard he worked to get to where he was in his career. I learned so much about him in the ICU. But when he was finally released from the hospital and went back to his home, he asked me not to contact him in the house, but he also told me he loved me very much. Then, a few days later, on October 20th, I received this email from him. Dear Tanya, I want to reiterate that I really enjoyed the time that we had together while I was in the hospital, and I do miss you very much. You are always in my thoughts, and have always been since you were a baby. I love you very much, Dad. About a week later, my dad passed away, with his wife by his side. If you look at my dad's credits on IMDb, his bio reads quite simply, "Moved to Los Angeles in the mid-1950s and found work on film and TV. Served impressively as art director for the film Big Fish." It also says on IMDb that his wife was Alma M. Stevens, and I'm here to say for the record that that's wrong. My dad's third wife was not a munchkin, my mom was not a munchkin, and I'm pretty sure his first wife was not a munchkin either. Anyway, the days and weeks following his funeral were a blur of grief and rage. One night on the internet, I sought out and reached out to Daniel Wallace, the author of Big Fish, and sent him an email to tell him my story. He wrote me back, and I want to share this excerpt with you. He writes, "My father died before Big Fish was ever published, and we did have a pretty rocky relationship, though not one near so rocky as yours with your father. All I have is writing. When I write, I have access to information I never knew I had and couldn't articulate in any other way. Sometimes I don't even know what I'm saying until I say it and see what it is I've said. I like what you're doing with your podcasts. I think that's a very cool and interesting way to go with this, a path of discovery. The really good things that have come from my writing have been certain understandings, that is, why was he the way he was? Why did he do the things he did? It doesn't make everything better. I am who I am largely because of him, and my biggest flaws are my biggest inheritance. But understanding who he was apart from being my father, which, after all, is only one of the things he was, helps me get past the personal part of it. Because in a strange way, it's not personal. The accident of childbirth is just another event. A big event, perhaps the biggest, but still, just another event in the life of a complicated, flawed man. Signed, Daniel Wallace. In the early days of the writer's strike, I met a journalist on the picket line who wanted to know more about what I was doing on my podcast. After sharing with him what the purpose was, I asked him some advice on how I could do cold interviews with complete strangers, and his advice was to ask questions as if you were asking them for your mother. Well, I took his advice, but I changed things up a bit and instead asked people questions as if I was asking on behalf of my dad. My dad was a union man, and I know he would have bitched about this strike and how much it was hurting him, but I also know, because he told me this before, that union is union, to which my response to him was always, and family is family. He once told me off tape about his days working in the steel mills in Pennsylvania and about his first job when he came to California working at McDonnell Douglas in Santa Monica. But though he may have supported the strike in principle, when I imagine what he would have said if he knew I was producing a daily podcast and how much work it entailed, I believe he would have told me I was nuts. I won't dispute that. My time on the line has been both challenging and rewarding. On the one hand, it's been such a fabulous opportunity to share creative ideas with some of this town's most intelligent and creative people. And there have been many, many writers on the line who have shared with me their experience of how they survived the loss of their parents. Like, for instance, this strike captain did at the CBS Radford Gate. Okay, well, you know, I lost my dad 2 years ago, but I, you know, let me ask you, I don't think that kind of wound of losing a parent ever goes away, does it?
I don't know if you can call it a wound, but you never forget. I think of my parents every day, and my dad's been gone 24 years. Hold on. I just want to make sure. Car coming in! Sorry if that
That's all right. I understand.
But I want to make sure everybody's safe.
Do you think of your dad every year?
Yeah, I think of my dad almost every day.
Yeah?
Yeah. And I miss him almost every day, but in a good way.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what keeps him alive in your head, isn't it? It's just, you know, we got pictures up. We do a lot of family pictures on the wall. A cousin of mine sent me a picture of my parents on their honeymoon I had never seen before.
Wow.
Brilliant, walking down the street. My dad's in a double-breasted suit. This is like 1945.
Aww.
My mom is gorgeous, you know. It was taken in low light, so it has that grainy, really 1940s look. And, you know, yeah, you keep your parents in your head all the time.
Yeah.
You never... then they're never dead.
You know,
that's the way I think of it. Try to keep the memories alive.
Yeah.
So that's good, yeah. Because I liked my parents. I never had any great conflict with them, so, you know. And they've been gone a long time, but you keep them there. That's all.
What's your name and why are we here? So,
my name is Steve Leyva. I am here picketing, as we have been for months.
That was Strike Captain Steve Leyva at the picket line at the CBS Radford Gate. Coming up is a continuation of a conversation I had with my father, Roy Barnes, in the intensive care unit at St. Joseph's Hospital in Burbank. Here we go. What do you think of the collaborative art process in filmmaking?
I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good way to make a film. To get a product on the screen, it has to be a collaborative process, especially when you have directors who are in control, they're all powerful. You have to collaborate with him or her, and he has to collaborate with you. Although a lot of times their egos are so big they don't like to admit they're collaborating with you, but they do. They have to. They have no choice. Or nothing would ever get put on the screen. You have all these different trades. Okay, you got this. You got the production designer. You got the set designers. You got start at the beginning. You got the director. Then you have the production designer. Then you have the art director under the production designer. Then you have the set designers under the art director. Then you have the different, the other trades. You have the set decorator. Then you have the painters and you have the carpenters. And you have the construction supervisor. And every step of the way, you're collaborating with all those different, I'm not saying it right, trades is not the right word.
Departments.
You got the different departments. You have to work with the camera department. You got to work with the costumer. You have to work with the set decorator. You have to work with the painters. Every step of the way, you got to work with all those different departments. You got to work with the guys who do the lighting. So they know where you're putting the walls, so they can put their grids, the things above, so they can put their lights on it. And it's a collaborative process every step of the way with that. And you especially have to work with the construction coordinator, because he's the guy who's in charge of getting it all built and painted and on time, ready to shoot on the day. And if you can't do that, you'll never work in the business. You have to have it there. It has to be ready on the day. Because every time you hold up as a day shoot, it's like $100,000 or $200,000, depending on the size of the project. But the most important, as I see it, is the director to production designer, art director to construction coordinator, so he can get it built on time and laid out. And then you work with the painters. Technically, the painter works for the construction coordinator, but painter can only paint something that's there. You can't paint in thin air. So long before the walls are built, the art director or production designer is working with the painter and with the costumer, because the costumers and the director want the colors to feature their characters. Like they have definite concepts about what the character, how he dresses, what kind of colors he wears, to accentuate the mise-en-scene image of what the character is trying to do. They may have the female lead in bright colors if she's a bright, cheery person. I'm using generalities here. Or they may have her in dark colors if she's like in therapy and everything's negative, and they don't want a lot of bright colors around her on the walls and on the furniture, you know. So it's all collaborative. You have to work with all that to get what the director's vision is. And then in the long run, the only really important thing is the director's vision. It's not what you want. It's not what the production designer wants, although part of it is what he wants. But he has to acquiesce to the director, what the director's vision is. And good directors have a vision. They may not be able to describe it very well, but if you sit down with them and you work through it with them, and you have department head meetings with them, you can work out a pretty good facsimile of what he's trying to get. And then if you can get him on the set 2 or 3 days early, and that's hard to do sometimes, you have time to modify it, things that he may comment on, he or she. You have like 2 days to repaint something or redecorate the furniture over here, or get a new couch, or get rid of those lights and put some other lights in there, or put a new rug on the floor. But if you can, oftentimes you can't get the director on the set to the day he shoots it, and that I've seen turn into a disaster. And director gets grumpy, gets upset. Everybody's running around like crazy, trying to help him get his vision. Set decorators are rolling up carpets, taking out furniture, bringing in new furniture. Painters are running around like changing colors of walls. And the paint's not even dry yet, and they're shooting it. Because the director, too busy to come on the set a day early or 2 days early, and bless it one way or the other. Bless it or unbless it, at least give people a chance to fix it. Because I think they like to see all these people jumping around and doing what they're told to do by him. I think they do. I think a lot of them like that. Gives them a sense of power.
So you've been in your capacity of working in the entertainment industry, you've been everything from a set designer to an art director and everything in between. What's your favorite position and why?
Well, depending on what they got me doing. I was working on the theme parks for Universal in Japan and Florida. I liked the art director because I was functioning almost as a production designer in a film. Come up with the concept, do some drawings, come up with the colors, supervise the colors, the painting of the what were called color boards, and every facade in all those projects for Universal had its own color board. And I would work with the different artists. We would have the drawing already done, and then they would take the drawing and mount it on a board, and then they would paint it. And I would, in collaboration with them, not as a dictator, because I know they're artists and they're painters, and they have a better eye for color than I do, because they're working with it every day. We would do these color boards for every facade, showing exactly what the colors are going to be when it was finished. So I really liked that process as an art director in a theme park, because I had a lot of power. I was able to get a lot of things done. But as working on a film, I don't want to have the responsibility of being an art director on a film. It's too hard. The business has changed in the last 30 years, and even before that, 50 years. But 30 years has changed so much that the art director has become a whipping boy, and they work 60 and 70 hours a week. It's not unknown for art directors to be working 60 hours, 70 hours a week, being driven by the producers, because the producers think we all make too much money anyway. And so they drive the art director. And especially if it's a show that's like being done, has a lot of location sets around town, you got to drive all over town, get the sets ready, through traffic. You got to get up at 4 in the morning to get at the first set, and you got carpenters hanging out wondering, well, what do you want me to do here? Well, that's when you first start. And you got to make sure they're doing it right. Then you drive to the next set. You may have 3 or 4 sets sometimes, not all the time, location sets around town. Then you got to come back to the studio, and you got sets being built on the stages. Then you're always fielding calls, phone calls. Then you got meetings with the director and the production designer. You got meetings with him. And usually the production designer and art director work pretty good together because they know each other. But you're working your ass off. And you're getting paid good for it, but it's not worth it. I found, as I grew older and working in films, that I didn't want that responsibility because I just don't want to drive all over town. Sometimes you have to drive to Palmdale or to Barstow or to Baker, and you got to drive back the same day. because we got sets going on out there, but you got to check on the other sets that are being built on stage or another location in town or in Santa Monica someplace. So I decided to concentrate, because I can draw so well, construction dock drawings, and they're so, my drawings are nice drawings, and everybody loves my drawings for construction drawings, and I can do it so fast, and or they're organized so well that the carpenters love my work, production designer and art director love my work because it's so clear, and I come in at 8 and I go home at 6, and I don't have to run all over town, and I don't make quite as much money as the art director, but I make enough without all the responsibility and tension and angst. Yeah. And I feel better, I feel happier. So that's why I like being a set designer in my later years.
And you've worked with some of the biggest and best, like Clint Eastwood and...
Worked with Clint.
You did, didn't you work in Milagro production?
No, that wasn't with Clint. That was with Redford.
Oh! Wait, didn't you work on that Space Cowboy movie?
On Space Cowboys, yeah. It was only 6 weeks, but I never saw Clint. I worked with Henry Bumstead, who was Clint's production designer, who passed away last March. And Clint was at the funeral. We went to the funeral. I was in... I was about two-thirds of the way through with chemotherapy. And Henry Bumstead, we all called him Bummy. We all loved him. He loved my work, too. He died of prostate cancer. He was 93 or 94. And he had been Clint's production designer for years. Clint seems to only trust the old-timers.
Yeah.
God bless him.
Yeah.
And there in San Marino, that's where Bummy lived. Clint, when he was still alive and working on the Flags of Our Fathers, which is just coming out, Clint would send a car over to San Marino every morning, pick him up, and about 3 or 4 o'clock, he would go home, and he was dying of cancer at the time, prostate cancer. And they had the funeral over there at some church in San Marino, a beautiful church. And I was in two-thirds of the way through my own chemo for lung cancer. And I went to the funeral. I dragged myself to the funeral because I knew all my friends were going to be there. I dragged myself. I sat. I didn't move around very much because I couldn't. When you're in the midst of chemo, it's hard to move around. You got to sit. Anyway, Clint showed up. Gave a great eulogy of Henry. And... yeah, I worked with Clint on Space Cowboys, but I don't think I ever saw him. I did go on the stage once when he was shooting. The thing about Clint, he's a no-nonsense guy. He gets the camera set up, he gets the actors in place. He said, okay, this is a rehearsal. And he shoots the rehearsal.
Okay.
Then he'll say, okay, now this is for real. And
first team.
Yeah. But he shoots the rehearsal. Then he says, okay, now we're gonna do the first team, this is the first shot. We're gonna actually shoot this. This is for real. And he shoots that. And he says, okay, that's good enough, cut.
No. Oh, I love it.
That's what he does.
I love it.
Yeah. He says, on to the next, they move on to the next one. And he moves chop, 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 chop so fast.
Check the gate.
Yeah, he's just so, he knows, I mean, he's watching.
Yeah.
And then he intercuts he likes to shoot the rehearsals because they're kind of, they can be spontaneous.
The real stuff's there.
It's more real.
Yeah.
And then he intercuts that with the real take that it's the second time. That's what makes him so successful. He's a no-nonsense guy. I like that. He's pretty cool that way. And he starts... I mean, he doesn't... I don't know what time he starts on the set. most of the time they're on a set like 6:30. I don't know what time Clint's on the set. He's getting up there in age enough, so he probably doesn't like to get up. Be there at 6:30 or 5:30 like some of them. But he likes to get out of there by 5 or 6 o'clock. Let's go home. The day's work's done. And, you know, everything works. You can't criticize it. That's what I call talent. This is talent that comes from years and years and years of doing it. It's not somebody who's a flash in the pan who struggles with it and is so insecure about himself and his abilities that he has to like do 40 takes,
right,
and go way over budget and way over time and take the company way into the night, go into meal penalties. Clint's frugal. You almost call him cheap, but that's okay. That's great.
What's Robert Redford like?
Oh, completely the opposite. Redford is so irresponsible when he's directing. I don't know about when he's acting by himself and being directed by somebody. But when he's directing, he's irresponsible. He wouldn't show up on the set till 8 o'clock.
What time was crew time?
Crew time would be like 6 or 6:30. But he would keep the crew waiting. And he wouldn't show up till 8 or 8:30. And then he was doing something with his... Oh, and he would fly up. He was driving his Porsche. He'd leave the hotel and he would drive up the mountain and taking the turns, and got stopped a couple of times by the New Mexico Highway Patrol because he was driving too fast. And then he'd get on the set, and I remember he had a daughter, and she wasn't in the movie, but he was trying to get her into some sort of school, or something was going on. I mean, she was having some problems or something getting into school, and he would arrive like 2 hours late, and crew was sitting around waiting for him. And then he'd sit with his daughter for another hour and a half. And then...
What, talking to her?
Yeah.
While he was working?
He wasn't working.
Well, while he was purportedly...
He was supposed to be working. Yeah. And then... I may be exaggerating a little bit, but...
That's some dad.
But yeah. Then he would... He'd say, okay... He'd say, let's go, just to her. He'd say, we're going to lunch. And the crew would be standing around waiting. Well, what are we going to do? So then, this happened more than once. So then he'd go to lunch with her or take her somewhere, do something with her. And then he'd come back after lunch, and maybe he would get one shot out of the day, if he was lucky. So irresponsible. And that happened more than once. He was always late on the set. There were days when there's no daughter around or nobody to distract him, but he would keep the crew waiting. And if he never got on the set before 8, and the crew was always on there like at 6, waiting for something to do. And he didn't have anybody to distract him. Then he'd get into doing something. He would get some shots going, but it was like, I gotta take my daughter to the airport. He'd just leave. Just take off and go. Take his daughter to the airport. And leave everybody standing around with their finger up their butt.
What was Sylvester Stallone like?
He's an asshole. Complete, utter asshole. Arrogant.
Was he professional?
He worked hard. Yeah. When he was working, he worked hard. Yeah, he did work hard. I give him that. But he was arrogant. One of the most arrogant people I've ever met.
What was the last project you were working on before you got sick?
Mission Impossible 3.
Which came out this summer.
Yeah. I couldn't go to the screening because I was sick from the chemo, but I didn't want the guys to see me as I was, because I was a mess. I had lost 20-some pounds. I'd lost all my hair.
We'll conclude this episode of the Writer's Strike Chronicles with a recording my dad and I made way back in the day when I was just a little girl.
Tanya?
Say Pledge Allegiance to the flag.
Pledge Allegiance.
Say it loud.
But I really want to say it.
Come on, say it. Say it with me. Say, I pledge allegiance to the flag. Come on, say it.
I see it.
No, come on, listen. Leave that alone. Now I want you to say, I pledge allegiance. And we'll play it back so you can hear it, okay? Oh, come on. I pledge allegiance. You say it after me, okay? I pledge allegiance.
Okay.
Say it loud. Say, I pledge allegiance real loud.
I pledge allegiance.
To the flag.
To the flag.
Of the United States.
Of America.
And to the Republic.
Of which you stand.
No, you say it. And to the Republic.
To the Republic.
For which it stands. One nation.
Under God.
With liberty,
liberty
and justice
for all.
Now, say something else. Say something else.
I love you, Dad.
Say something else. Say what your name is. Say, my name is.
My name is.
Say your name. Tanya.
Tanya.
Tamarinda.
Tamarinda.
Barnes.
Barnes.
And I live?
I live.
On Coldwater Canyon. North?
North.
Hollywood?
Hollywood.
California?
California.
And I go?
Go?
To Miss Sally's school.
To Miss Sally's school.
You say, and I go to Miss Sally's school.
And I go to Miss Sally's school.
What do you learn at school?
Art.
What else do you learn?
Play.
What else? What did you do today?
I just play with my friend named Debbie. She loves me now.
She does.
You have been listening to the Writer's Strike Chronicle podcast, available for free through iTunes. For more information, visit us at www.strikechronicles.com. To contact us, please call 310-439-8754 or send us an email at info@strikechronicles.com.